Twisted Sisters Crime will contain mature content, graphic descriptions, and violence.
Listener discretion is advised. This podcast may upset trauma survivors. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 2. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Aubrey.
Today we're going to be taking our stories to the Great Lakes state of Michigan. So let's go over some criminal stats we have for ya.
So Michigan's percent is at a 4.37 per 1,000 residents, which means you have a 1 in every 299 people chance of becoming a victim of violent crime in Michigan.
It looks like in 2019, Michigan had 556 murders, 7,235 rapes, 5,350 robberies, and 30,545 assaults that have been reported.
So all of this data was pulled from neighborhoodscout.com, and this isn't sponsored still, but it's just a good site for these statistics. So with that, we also want to invite you to follow us on our social links. We're on Instagram at @twisted_sisters_crime, Twitter at @twistedcrime, and the E on crime is a 3, and then Facebook, where you can search for our group called Twisted Sisters Crime Podcast.
Or you can also just go to our website at twistedsisterscrime.com, find out all of the links at the bottom. We are starting to get some merch figured out, and may or may not hold a contest for you guys all to win stuff. So yeah.
That sounds like fun. I want free merch, but I mean.
Me too. I like clothes.
All right. So with all of that out of the way, let's get started. And Crystal has a wonderful and scary story for us today.
All right, guys. I chose Benjamin Atkins today. So let's get started with Benjamin. Benjamin was born on August 26, 1968. He was the younger of his two brothers. He also lived in a poor neighborhood. His parents were drug and alcohol users. So he was born in 1968, but he also ran away in 1970, meaning he was 2 years old when he ran away from his home without parental supervision. He did end up in an orphanage.
So he's just like this little two-year-old just walking down the street like, no, so I don't want to do it with my family.
It's the saddest thing. Being two, like my son's 3. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine him doing that.
Like that would be so sad to see this little child just walking out.
And it's like, he lived in the scariest streets too. Like, prostitutes, pimps.
Maybe it's a good thing a good thing he didn't become a victim first.
True.
But he also shouldn't have done what he did. But, you know.
So while Benjamin was living in the orphanage, he was sexually assaulted by other children. And at the age of 10, he was raped by one of the employees. Over the next 5 years, he was still assaulted, which led him to escape and try and find his mother. So then after he found his mother, he realized that she was working as a prostitute. Due to this, he left the house again in the late 1980s. He started living on the streets. It led him to doing drugs, and it eventually developed into a drug addiction. Because he lacked education, he had to work low-wage jobs and slept his nights in homeless shelters. So in Benjamin's free time, he visited places that inhabited pimps and prostitutes.
Well, he's got a nice, solid upbringing so far. So, you know, I don't know what went wrong.
I don't either. So from 1991 to 1992, Benjamin raped and strangled 11 women. They were found in abandoned hotels and buildings near Woodward, Michigan, and Detroit, Michigan. Now, as for his victims, Atkins liked to choose young to middle-aged women. They were often prostitutes and drug addicts. Atkins said he was driven by pure hatred of prostitutes. So in my thinking, I would think he did that because of his mother.
Yeah, like, I don't want to go all, like, Agent Hotchner and Criminal Minds this, but...
Yes, please do.
I mean, considering, like, what I know from the show that I've seen, that definitely screams to me his hatred of his mother, because he left the orphanage to find her, and then he's like, oh, you're just a prostitute, like, screw you, I'm leaving again. So, yeah. But then it's interesting, too, because he went into that lifestyle of drugs and stuff, so he was at fault for his own stuff that he hated, so...
Right. I think, in my opinion, if it was me personally, he saw his mother as that, and he resented her so much mm-hmm. for, you know, letting him just run away and then become a victim of sexual assault at such a young age. Mm-hmm. And so when he did find his mom again and...
I guess it could also be, like, a lot of sexual trauma because of all of that abuse
right.
that he got. And then he goes and he finds his mom's a sex worker. And he's like, are you kidding me?
Right.
Like, really, mom?
Yeah.
So I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Psychology-wise. Uh-huh. Even though we have no degrees.
We don't have any degrees. But if it helps, I've always passed my psychology classes.
I have watched Criminal Minds since I was 8 years old. I am a professional.
Quote unquote. All right, so Benjamin would lure these prostitutes into abandoned buildings. He would then sexually assault them, sodomize them, and then strangle them.
All right, so can you kind of explain what sodomize is? Because I don't think that's a familiar term.
My research on sodomize, if you go to Google, it means having anal intercourse with someone. So not only like raping them, they also he also just butt raped them in like non-nice terms. Atkins was arrested on rape charges on August 21st, 1992. That was after he was identified on the Detroit streets by one of his first victims, Darlene Sanders. She was age 35. She had managed to escape him in October 1991.
Cool. You go, girl.
Right? Go her. After 12 hours of investigation, him sitting with police officers, talking about all this, mm-hmm. he had worked his way through 5 cheeseburgers.
Bro, I can do that in 5 minutes.
Right?
Just kidding.
But he just wanted the free burgers, yeah. I guess.
Like, I'd be like, maybe give me another burger and I'll tell you where I hid the bodies.
He did. He did.
Yeah.
He confessed to the 11 murders. Atkins described in detail appearance and clothing of his victims. He did even indicate the whereabouts of his 10th victim. That's going to be 22-year-old Osenia Waymer. Sorry if I pronounced that wrong. According to his testimony, he didn't intend on killing her, but after being rejected, he just flew into a rage. So, like I said, he did admit to the 11 killings. He was charged with 11 counts of first-degree murder and 1 first degree of sexual contact. He was also sentenced to 11 life sentences. After all of the court hearings that he attended, all he cared about was getting cigarettes after these courts. Like, he didn't show any emotion, just wanted cigarettes to, I don't know, dull the pain maybe?
I would want my cheeseburgers again, but, you know.
Right?
Everyone
Me
to
too.
Themselves.
Benjamin did die 4 years into an 11 life sentence. Benjamin died at the age of 29 due to HIV.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you go and you rape 11 people, you're bound to get an STD, so.
Yeah, kind of sad. So his victims are as listed. These are all of the girls. We have Darlene Sanders. She was 35, attacked and raped. On October 1991, she was the one who had survived. There was Debbie Ann Friday. She was 30, found strangled on December 14th, 1991. There was Bertha Jean Mason. She was 26, found strangled on December 30th, 1991. Patricia Canyon George, she was 36, found strangled on January 3rd, 1992. Vicky Truelove, she was 39, found strangled on January 25th, 1992. Valerie Chalk, she was 34, found strangled on February 17th, 1992. Juanita Hardy, she was 23. She was also found strangled on February 17th, 1992. And then last on that same day, there was a Jane Doe they could not identify. She was found strangled on February 17th, 1992. These three girls were all found in the same hotel, an abandoned hotel. And then we have Brenda Mitchell. She was 38, found strangled on April 9th, 1992. Vicky Beasley Brown, she was 43, found strangled on April 15th, 1992. There's Joanne O'Rourke. Sorry if I said the last name wrong. She was 40, found strangled on June 5th, 1992. And then his last victim was Osenia Waymer. Sorry if I pronounced that wrong again. And she was 22, and she was found strangled on August 21st, 1992. Now, I do have all of the links that I found, all of this information, and a couple pictures that we've found on Benjamin. You can check that all out on our website. Again, our website is twistedsisterscrime.com. Now, I'm going to hand it over to Aubrey, and she's got a crazy story for you guys.
Okay, so my guy, his name is Carl Eugene Watts. He's a little interesting. He only got convicted of two murders, but he is suspected to have murdered more than 80 people.
Holy.
So get ready for a roller coaster.
I'm ready.
All right.
Are you guys?
No.
Okay.
Let's Too bad. It. So Carl Eugene Watts was born on November 7th of 1953 in Killeen, Texas. When he was about two, his parents got divorced and Watts and his mother moved to Inkster, Michigan. When he was there, he changed his name to Coral, since that was how his name Carl sounded with the southern accent there. As a child, he was described as strange, and he even claims that he started fantasizing about killing girls and young women at the age of 12.
Dang.
Fun.
I couldn't imagine. I have nieces and nephews that are 12, and if I knew that they were thinking of things like that, I just don't know where I would begin with it.
And like nothing, like with Benjamin, he had all this trauma. With this guy, like his parents got divorced, that was it. So Watts began stalking girls before the age of 15, and it is even believed that he had already killed his first victim by then. When he was 13, he got meningitis and was forced to be held back in school. And since that, he had difficulty keeping up with his peers, he got failing grades, suffered from bullying, and did not reach a reading level above the third grade. So when Watts was 15, he was doing the newspaper route, and he knocked on a woman's door and assaulted her. When he was asked about it, he said he just felt like beating someone up. And so then on June 29th of 1969, Watts was arrested for sexually assaulting Joan Gave, who was 26 at the time. Once tried, he was sentenced to the Lafayette Clinic in Detroit, which is like a mental institution.
Is that for kids then?
Yeah, so he was okay. Still a, I think a he was minor. Like, yeah, he was younger, so. According to assessments, he suffered from mild mental retardation, delusional thoughts, and he only had an IQ of 68. Even with all this, though, the police officers that interrogated him later stated that he appeared to be very intelligent and in possession of an excellent memory. Dr. Gary Ainsworth explained Watts as a paranoid young man who is struggling for control of strong homicidal impulses. His behavior controls are faulty, and there is a high potential for violent acting out. This individual is considered dangerous. And then Watts was released from that clinic on November 9th of 1969, he only went back for occasional psychiatric help 9 times after that. So something important is at this time, there was a lot of confidentiality laws, and so even though he was considered dangerous and they thought he would have homicidal tendencies, they couldn't share that with anyone. And so he went back to high school like this.
Okay.
So that's fun. All right, so while he was in high school, he still struggled academically. So he did, however, excel in football and boxing, and he did end up graduating from school at 19 with his mother's help and tutoring in 1973, and he got a football scholarship to Lane College in Jackson, Tennessee. However, he was expelled after only 3 months for allegations surrounding him concerning stalking and assaulting women. There was also a brutal murder of a female student at the time that he was under suspect for, but there was never enough evidence to convict him. So he returned home to Michigan with his mom and worked as a mechanic in Detroit, and then he quit and enrolled in Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He was 20 years old in 1974 when his serial killer career began. He was an African-American and almost always killed white women between the ages of 14 and 44 by strangulation, stabbing, bludgeoning, and drowning. Despite all the women he is said to have murdered, he was not discovered for almost 8 years. This is because he often murdered in different jurisdictions, different states. He rarely performed sexual acts on his victims, so there was not really much DNA left on them, and he was never suspected of any murders of people he knew because he always killed strangers. Let's start at the beginning. On October 25th of 1974, Lenore Konatsky went to answer her door and saw young Watts asking for somebody named Charles. Next thing she knew, Watts was strangling her. Luckily, Lenore was able to fight him off and then fled. She called police, but they were unable to find Watts at the time. On October 30th, Gloria Steele received a knock on her apartment door. This young man was also asking for someone named Charles. Gloria let him in, and Watts began to attack her with his knife. She was found dead with 33 stab wounds. On November 12th, Diane Williams reported the same incident, though she was able to fight him off and report his vehicle to police. Watts was arrested that December for assault and battery of Lenore Konatsky and Diane Williams. During questioning, he admitted attacking at least a dozen more women, but never admitted to murdering Gloria. Sergeant James Arthurs was on Gloria's case at the time and believed it was Coral, but he couldn't prove it. Watts was then sent to Kalamazoo State Hospital to undergo psychiatric evaluation before his court hearing. He was found impulsive, reckless, emotionally detached, and lacked remorse for his actions. They discerned that he was, however, able to distinguish right from wrong, and just diagnosed him with an antisocial personality disorder. During his stay at the hospital, he went into a slight depression and attempted to hang himself with a cord, though he did survive with only minor injuries.
What's sad is, in his teen years, he was diagnosed with this and no one told anybody. And then he goes on to hurt people in his college years and gets sent back to the hospital. And I feel like they knew at the time he was very dangerous, but maybe because it was not in the era that we live in now, things are totally different then to now. I don't know.
That's a big part, is now there is a lot more options to help people like this. Whereas then it was diagnose them and get them out. Like, mental illness was very...
just pushed to the side, almost.
So for his first trial, he pleaded no contest, and he served only a year for the assault on Lenore and Diane. By June of 1976, Watts was back out in the world. He went back to live with his mom in Detroit, and this, along with many other things, caused many to believe him that he was a mama's boy. So after this release, he dated a woman named Dolores. They never married, but they did end up having a child together. They did split up eventually, and then Watts started dating a girl named Valerie, and they married in 1979. This marriage only lasted 6 months. And later, Valerie said that Coral's behavior while they were together was really strange. She stated that he had violent nightmares, he became messy, he left clothes and even garbage on the floor. He would cut up houseplants with a knife and melt candles onto tables. She even said that every time after they had sex, Watts would leave the house for hours. In October of 1979, Watts was arrested for stalking around Southfield, Detroit. These charges did get dropped, although it was noted that in the previous year, 5 women were assaulted under similar circumstances to each other. None of those women from the year were killed, and none could identify their attacker. So, October 8th of 1979, Peggy Pochmara was strangled in Detroit. On Halloween, Jeanne Klein was walking home from a doctor's appointment and was stabbed 11 times in broad daylight along a busy suburban road near her house in Grosse Pointe Farms. Initially, they suspected her husband since they couldn't find evidence until years later when Watts confessed to killing her. And then in 1980, Watts claimed three other victims from Detroit in just 3 months. March 11th, Hazel Knopf was found strangled. March 31st, Denise Damore was found strangled. And May 31st, Linda Monteria was found strangled. So Ann Arbor is a city that's just 40 miles west of Detroit and houses the University of Michigan. In April of 1980, police were called to the house of Shirley Small, who was 17 at the time. She was attacked and had been repeatedly cut with what appeared to be a scalpel. She bled to death on her sidewalk. Next, Glenda Richmond died in July. She was 26 and found at her doorway, dead from over 28 stab wounds. Also in July, Irene Kondratowicz, and I'm sorry if I said her name wrong, she was from Windsor and she survived after having her throat slashed. Sandra Delp also lived after being stabbed from behind, and then Mary Agnes escaped Watts by screaming once she realized he was following her. She was able to pick him out of a photo lineup, but was unable to 100% say for sure it was him. Rebecca Huff had 54 stab wounds when she was found dead outside her door on September 14th. Because of all these murders, in a short span of time, with so much similar between the cases, a task force was formed. Detective Paul Button led this team. Unfortunately, there was still no evidence and still no witnesses. Sergeant James Arthurs from Gloria Steele's case heard about these murders in Ann Arbor and the similarity to his case and contacted the task force about his theory on Carl Watts being involved. Because of this and discovering that Watts' car was recorded leaving Windsor after the three attacks in July, Watts became Button's leading suspect, so now he has two detectives kind of eyeing him and being like, oh boy. So Detective Button first increased patrols in and around the town. Luckily, because of this, on November 15th, two policemen patrolling Ann Arbor around 5 in the morning found a suspicious car following a woman home. She realized she was being followed and hid in a doorway. The officers observed the man in the car frantically searching for her. When they pulled the car over, they could identify him as Coral Watts. Button said that Coral almost went nuts since he couldn't find the women he was after. Watts was then arrested for driving with expired plates and a suspended license. When searching his car, they found screwdrivers, wood filing tools, and a dictionary etched with the words, "Rebecca is a lover," which was found to be Rebecca Huff's. However, somehow this still was not enough evidence to convict him of anything.
Oh my goodness.
So then Button started round-the-clock surveillance on Watts. They inconspicuously hid a tracking device on his car so they could try to catch him. The officers on this task force were certain he was responsible for Shirley Small, Glenda Richmond, and Rebecca Huff. Watts knew he was being watched and suppressed his urges for 2 months. And finally, the police brought him in for questioning under a warrant to give a blood sample. Button interviewed Watts for 9 hours. And the only real emotion that they ever saw from him was when Button graphically described how he believed the women were killed. Watts then asked to call his mother, and after that he didn't talk. Eventually, he was released from custody because somehow his blood did not match the DNA in any of the cases. So in the spring of 1981, Coral moved to Columbus, Texas and started working at an oil company. Now he had to drive more than 70 miles to the Houston area for his new hunting ground. So he is out of Michigan at this point, but he'll come back. So don't worry, we're coming back. When Button found out about his move, he sent files on Watts to Houston homicide detective Doug Bostick. Sergeant Tom Ladd of that same department claimed it was difficult to build a case against Watts because he used different methods to kill, never sexually assaulted his victims, and always chose strangers. There's rarely evidence left behind because he killed within minutes of encountering his victims. And so because of this, the Houston police were not able to do anything at the time. They did start tailing his car as they had done in Ann Arbor, but they were not able to keep 24/7 tabs on him so that they wouldn't be charged with harassment. On September 5th of 1981, Linda Tilley was drowned in her apartment complex swimming pool. 1 week later, Elizabeth Montgomery was stabbed to death while out walking with her dogs. And later that same day, Susan Wolf was returning from getting ice cream when she was stabbed to death just as she got out of her car. January 4th of 1982, Phyllis Tam was found hanging near a small tree. Her death was assumed a suicide until years later, when Watts admitted that he choked her in hunger in a treatment. So now we have two cases that weren't originally tied to him until he admitted it later, so. On January 17th of 1982, Margaret Fosse was found dead with a blow to her throat. Her body was found in the trunk of her car at Rice University. Coral admitted that he took her shoes and blueprints she had and had burned them. Here's some people that Watts thought he killed but they ended up getting away. So he claimed that he murdered Julia Sanchez on the freeway, saying that when her tire blew out and pulled over, he slashed her throat and left her for dead. Fortunately, she did survive, escaping in the car of a motorist who stopped for her. On January 29th, Watts followed Alice Martel to her Seabrook apartment and stabbed her 3 times with an ice pick. And then on January 30th, Watts tried to kill Patty Johnson by slashing her throat. And at the time, Howard Ware Mosley was accused and sent to jail for the attempted murder of Johnson before they were able to get Watts' confession later. So now there's 3 cases.
And these 3 cases are, 2 of them are in Texas and 1 of them is in
Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So 2 of them, one of them is just, they thought it was a suicide, one of them they thought it was her husband, and then this other one they thought it was just some random guy.
Well, she was random, yeah. But she had survived it.
She had survived, and so the guy was just charged with assault. February 7th, Elena Samander was found dead in Houston. She was strangled with her own shirt. Watts disposed of her in the trash bin. March 20th, Emily Lacroix was strangled after having just moved from Seattle. At first, they thought that she was a runaway until her body was found 5 months later stuffed in a culvert. And I kind of looked up that word, so like, what the heck is that? It's kind of like a sewage drain.
Okay.
Or like a gutter. Like, it's kind of the same thing, but not, so. March 27th, Edith Ledet was stabbed in Galveston when she was coming back from a graduation party. This part's fun. Watts also tried to attack Glenda Kirby later that morning, but she slipped from his grasp because he was still covered in Edith's blood.
Oh my goodness.
And like...
So he literally went from killing this girl from the graduation party to attacking Glenda.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't go and...
Clean up.
Mm-hmm. He just went...
He was ballsy.
Straight from one girl to
and
the
I think
next.
It's so gross because like when blood's that old, it's all like... jelly, you know?
Right.
And so, like, ugh.
I couldn't imagine.
But, like, hey, Glenda got away, so.
We're good.
Yolanda Garcia was stabbed to death on her front lawn, clutching her bag containing her work shoes. April 16th, Carrie Jefferson was abducted around 2 a.m., strangled, and then stabbed twice. She was buried along the White Oak Bayou. And then on April 21st, Suzanne Searless was grabbed when she was returning home from a party. When Watts was strangling her, he couldn't tell if she was dead, so he held her head in a flower pot of water, and then he buried her. So May 23rd is Watts' big day. This is finally when it's all coming to a close. Michelle Madej was returning home around 4 a.m. She was beat and choked until she was unconscious. And then Watts filled her tub with water and drowned her in it before he ran away. Later that day, Lori Lister came home, unaware she was being followed. She got out her key when suddenly Watts came up behind her and strangled her when she was almost unconscious. She later told People Weekly that she prayed not for her life, but simply that her body would be recovered. Like, that breaks my heart.
That's so sad.
Like,
I would almost be the same way, though.
I would definitely be that way. But
I would just pray that they could find the person. It would be hard. It mm-hmm. would be so hard.
And hearing people like that, like, it just, you can't even imagine the terror in that situation until it happens to you, and you never want it to happen to you. And that's just, I couldn't imagine having that thought, like, all right, I'm gonna die. I just kind of hope that they find me so that my friends and family can have closure.
Yeah.
Like, ugh.
Yup.
So she was able to let out a small scream, which probably saved her and her roommates' lives. Neighbors heard her scream and immediately called the police. So Watts brought Lori into her apartment and was confronted by Melinda Aguilar, who was her roommate at the time. He threatened to slash Melinda's throat if she screamed and began to choke her until she went limp. And this girl's smart, so she pretended to go unconscious. And then he wrapped her hands behind her back and placed her on the bed. He also bound Lori's hands and feet and then went in the bathroom to fill the tub with water. While he was gone, Melinda jumped off the bedroom's balcony and began screaming for help, and then moments later, police arrived. When Watts heard them, he tried to escape, but he was apprehended. The neighbor who had called 911 after hearing Lori's scream ran into the apartment and found her head in the bathtub water and luckily pulled her out in time. So both roommates survived the attack. L.W. Damian, I'm sorry if I said that wrong, and Donnie Schmidt were the two arresting officers at this scene. When he was interrogated, Watts refused to talk, so Harris County Assistant District Attorney Ira Jones surprisingly made him a deal of immunity to the charges of murder if he confessed to the open cases they had suspected him in. Judge Doug Shaver agreed to let Watts plead guilty to one charge of burglary with the intent to murder and only give the maximum charge of 60 years. He also stipulated that Watts must cooperate to solve the murders and find any bodies he buried. Watts confessed to killing 22 people in Texas, Ann Arbor, Kalamazoo, Detroit, and Windsor. When asked why he tried to kill these girls, Watts said that they had evil eyes and he wanted to release their spirits. He also admitted to other murders in Michigan and Canada, but didn't want to give any details since he had no immunity for those charges. So Coral Watts pled guilty to one count of burglary with the intent to kill. On September 3rd of 1982, he was finally sentenced to 60 years in prison. Before leaving for prison, Watts stated, "If they ever let me out, I'll kill again." He was also heard stating that he never felt remorse for his victims. He was just scared of getting caught. So then months into his imprisonment, Watts tried to escape by covering himself with hair gel and trying to squeeze out of the cell window. And then when that didn't work, he said, "I think I'll just try more legal ways to get out now."
Okay.
He obviously didn't have Ted Bundy's skills of escaping prison, so.
He didn't.
He was like, "All right, I guess if I have to."
But that also goes to show, as you said earlier, the mental retardation that they had, like, diagnosed him with.
Yeah.
Because his brain didn't think that way, whereas Ted Bundy thought differently.
Ted Bundy,
and was a little bit more smarter about things, as getting himself out of prison twice. Coral was not and didn't have that mental capacity to think
that. And I just want to know how he got enough hair gel to cover his whole body.
It would have had to have been months of his imprisonment, like you just said.
He's just saving up gel?
Oh, or made trades to people?
Like, you want a shiv? No, give me the gel.
There you go.
Okay. So, he began to appeal his sentence. Luckily for him, in 1989, the Texas Court of Appeals saw that the judge failed to inform Watts that the bathtub water he used to try to drown Lori in was considered a lethal weapon. So that made his case kind of go upside down, and now he would not be required to serve his entire sentence. After this, he was considered nonviolent and was allowed to earn good time credits for being a model prisoner. Then he was classified as a Class 1 inmate and was allowed to receive credit for 2 to 3 days of reduction for every one day served. At this point, Watts was due to be released on May 9th of 2006. This horrifies his survivors and families of the victims, knowing he had admitted that he would kill again, because it was published in the paper when he left that he was like, "Yo guys, I'm gonna kill again if you let me out." So that's a little scary. So Lori Lister, who's the girl that survived that May attack, she stated she thought Coral would be put away for life and felt unprotected from the law. So once this was decided, authorities in Michigan and Texas began working hard to find evidence to tie him to other cases. So we all gotta praise this guy named Joseph Foy, okay? We're gonna go back in time a little bit. Helen Mae Dutcher was killed in December of 1979. Joseph Foy came forward in 2004, claiming he saw Watts murder her. He had actually responded to a television program back in 1982 about what he saw, stating he witnessed Helen struggling in an alleyway outside of a dry cleaner's while Watts reportedly stabbed her in the neck and back. She died with 12 stab wounds. When police got this information, they just kind of put her case on the back burner because they thought Watts would just die in prison. Which, also, to me, like, now you have an open case and you have a suspect, they don't care if you're in prison, they're gonna charge you.
But didn't he also say back that he admitted to these murders in Ann Arbor and Detroit.
Well, he was just kind of like, I also killed a lot of people in these other cities, but I'm not going to tell you anything about that.
Gotcha.
But okay. In 1982, there was this, when he first got arrested, there was this television program where they're like, if you know any information about this guy, let us know. And Joseph Hoy called and was like, hey, I saw him kill this lady. But by the time he called, they already got that other case. Yes. So they were like, whatever. We won't worry about it.
Okay.
Okay, so when Joseph Foy found out that Watts was going to come out, he actually called the police again and complained, saying, yo, I gave you guys information. Like, what are you doing? Cora Watts was convicted with the murder of Helen on November 17th of 2004 in Michigan after the jury heard Joseph Foy's testimony. December 7th, he was sentenced to life. Michigan started also making moves to try him for the murder of Gloria Steele. Watts' trial for Gloria began on July 5th of 2007. He was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without parole on September 13th, 2007. He was incarcerated in Iona, Michigan until September 21st when he died of prostate cancer. So unfortunately, he was only convicted of two of his murders because he died like a week after Gloria's case. So that sucks, but we know he did all the others, so.
Yeah, we do.
And then lastly, Joe Tilley, who is the father of Linda, stated that forgiveness cannot be bestowed when forgiveness is not sought. This is a confrontation with pure evil, with principles and the powers of the air.
That was such a great story on Coral.
I mean, that's his name, Coral.
Coral Watts, right? All these things that he ended up doing is just so sad. He did die for what he did.
I mean, kinda. He was sentenced to enough prison time that he wouldn't have made it out before dying, but it just sucks that, I mean, for the families at that time, they didn't necessarily get all the closure because he was never fully convicted for all the murders he caused.
So, ending this, that's all we have for you guys for this episode. Don't forget to rate us on where you're listening.
Yeah, and again, go ahead and find the social links to send us comments and questions, and all of our sources and some pictures from the cases will be on the blog at twistedsisterscrime.com. So other than that, we will have to wait until next time.
Until then, stay safe, stay smart, stay twisted.
Stay safe, stay smart, this is...